So some of you know, probably, that every time there's a camp like this, there's always somebody who's keeping Pier Zia's schedule. This time it's been me with some help from Kenneth. And Baba meets with people throughout the camp. And very often people ask about this topic of initiation. What does it mean to be initiated? People feel a calling to be initiated. A number of us here in this room are already initiated in some form. So tomorrow morning, during the morning break, Baba will be offering initiations. And Amita Carey, who's here with me, is a part of our esoteric school and the head of the retreat concentration, and is here to answer any questions about initiation, not just here in this moment, but during the meals between now and tomorrow morning. Yeah, you can meet Amita at dinner, and also, or anywhere you see her. And Baba, I don't know if you want to say anything about initiation. Yeah, because now we have different types of initiation, and one is called an ashik. It's a blessing into the order, into any of the activities. And I want Baba to explain that a little bit. And then also the initiation into the esoteric school, which all of us who consider ourselves Marids, that's typically the initiation. So, Baba. Good.
Thank you. Yes, there are different kinds of initiation in life. There's what is called a natural initiation, which occurs in the course of one's journey at pivotal moments, moments of great transition, when one's perception of reality undergoes a reorganization. Sometimes that kind of natural initiation is brought about by a life-changing event, such as the death of someone near and dear, or a brush with death on one's own part, or a powerful dream that compels you to take an unexpected step in life. It happens sometimes that the whole trajectory of one's life is transformed. Often that transformation is gradual, but sometimes it's sudden. And these are natural initiations. And then there is the initiation which is entry into a community, entry into a circle of belonging, a caravan of companionship, a tradition of practice. In Sufism, there are, broadly speaking, two major kinds of initiation into the companionship of the way. One is called Bayate Tabarruk, initiation of blessing. And this may be undertaken if one feels a sincere sympathy and friendship and companionship with the community of those who travel a certain path together. And there's no restriction in it. One could enter through Bayate Tabarruk, a certain order, and another order, without contradiction. One could have this affiliation of friendship and solidarity in several places and be part of several overlapping communities and receive all of the blessings of those various communities and the ways of those communities. So that is Bayate Tabarruk. And in the Anaiti order, through Bayate Tabarruk, one enters into that larger movement that includes the universal worship and kinship and healing and zarat and chivalry without necessarily specializing in and venturing into any one of them, although the doors are open for those who resolve to venture in, and that resolution then would require a certain discernment, a certain clear intention, and with that a commitment. And each of these activities has its form and the way into that form, the training, the personal practice, and so forth. Amongst these is the activity which is the first of the activities, really the tarika of the Anaitiya, and which is the culmination and fusion of four great historical lineages, primarily Chishtiya, Sarvardiya, Qadariya, and Naqshbandiya, as established in the West and renewed by Hazrat Pir Moshe Inayat Khan in 1910 in the form of the Inayati Tariqat. And so entry into the esoteric school is entry into the Tariqat, which for those who seek guidance on the path, one may venture to inquire whether that step would be appropriate in one's life at this time. It would certainly require of one a very clear intention, because it would mean entering into work with a guide. That is to say, to find within the tariqat a unauthorized guide who would become one's mentor, whom one would meet with from time to time and receive a practice. And one's intention would be to do that practice every day, to maintain a daily practice. Otherwise, there would be no reason to enter into the tariqat, the esoteric school. One would happily be a companion on the way within the community and a fellow traveler. But those who wish to undergo focused spiritual study with a mentor through daily practice, going through the stages of study, studying the esoteric papers that Murshid has given, the gathas, gitas, sangatas, sangitas, and pursuing that internal curriculum of concentration, contemplation, meditation, and realization that constitutes the inner journey. And not to do so while at the same time receiving instructions from and practicing instructions from another mentor in another way. Not because there is only one true way, but because though several boats may go out from one dock, if one foot is in one boat and the other foot is in one boat, at the dock they may be side by side, but on the ocean they may be apart. And so the boats, each of them will reach the destination, but the one with a foot in each may not. So entry into the esoteric school means that one would resolve that this would be the inner path of practice that one would pursue with focus. And that's a very serious decision, of course, one that also isn't made unilaterally by oneself. It emerges through inquiry. What would it mean? Am I at that point in my life when this is called for? And if the definite resolution is there, and if the answer is one of affirmation, then initiation means the opening of a door, and more can be said. And Amida will say more. For those who wish to hear more, please do go and speak with Amida, who can tell you so much more. To sum up, there is the Bayati Tabarruk, the initiation of blessing that is open to all and makes one a companion of the community and a lover of the message that this community exists to serve, and one becomes an ashik. Whereas through Bayati Hakikat, one would enter the esoteric school and become a murid. Also, each of the activities has its initiation. Initiation into healing, to study the healing path and become a practitioner of the healing service. Entry into universal worship, which might lead in time to becoming a sharag of the universal worship and performing the service, having that training. Kinship, the study and practice of oneness between us. And Zirat, the inner agriculture. And chivalry, which leads to the theme I'd like to continue to explore with you this afternoon, as we've been exploring it these last afternoons. The history of chivalry, the source in prophetic lineage, the principles of chivalry. We've spoken of Abraham and Sarah and Hagar. We've spoken of Sheikh Abul Hasan Kharaqani. Now I would like to circle back to the master of chivalry with whom our exploration began on the first day, and that is Noor, Pirzadi Shahida Noor Anisa Inayat Khan. I've been telling stories these afternoons, and in doing so, I'm only following, or trying to follow, in the footsteps of Noor, because she was first and foremost a storyteller. She dedicated her life to stories. And in the end, having told so many heroic tales, tales of heroism and self-sacrifice, her own life became her greatest story. her own life became her ultimate story of self-giving. It isn't surprising that Noor became a storyteller, if one knows her story. She was born in Moscow in 1914. Her parents were Hazrat Inayat Khan and Amina Begum, nay Aura Ray Baker. Her mother American, her father Indian, and she born in a Russian Orthodox monastery near the Kremlin when Murshid was collaborating with Sergei Tolstoy on an opera based on Shakuntala. So she was born into a milieu of art, music, and poetry, and, of course, Sufism. The family had to suddenly leave Russia amidst revolution and arrived in Paris and finally in London. And Murshid was playing his veena and bringing to the Western world for the first time Hindustani music and Sufism. And the Sufi order was born not so long after Noor An-Nisa was born in London during the First World War. There was a little circle that would meet. Murshid and his family lived in the Khanqa. The Khanqa was their home, and in the Khanqa, seekers would come to meditate, to listen to the sacred music. It was in that atmosphere that Noor grew, and at night, her father used to sing to her and also tell her stories. And those stories were seeds that were planted in her heart that sprouted and grew into a garden that in turn gave forth its own seeds. The stories that Murshid told lived in her, and she became, in time, a storyteller. How did she receive the teaching from her father, who was also her Murshid? Through stories. How would she serve in this world? Through stories. The family moved after the war to France. She grew up in Suresnes. And then came the Second World War. By that time, she was a young woman. She played the harp. She wrote poems. And the most enchanting poems are poems that she wrote every year to her mother. Every single year, there is a poem in which she expresses her deep love and reverence to her mother. But in the language of butterflies and flowers and humor, those are the sweetest poems. And we know that because she tells us that Murshid had taught her, her father had taught her, your first work in life, my daughter, is to love your mother. He called her attention to the love that she, her mother, gave to the children. Answer that love. That's your first work. And she, it came so naturally. It wasn't a discipline. It was a delight to love her mother. Ora Ray herself, Amina Begum, she studied and wrote about the relationship between parents and children, how to love one's children, how to teach them without burden, without imposition, to teach, but more importantly, to listen and see what the child has already brought from the inner world. Shine a light on that. So Noor grew in this way through love and expressed that love in her poems. Her poems are to her mother, deep poem to her brother Vilayat, who was, she said, to be her life's companion. And she studied child psychology. She was fascinated by how a self grows in love, how that self can be held, how it can be cultivated, how it can be brought to fruition. And the importance of stories in this. How stories serve the child, form the mind of the child. This led her into folklore. What are the great stories of the world? Where have they come from? How have they been transmitted? She studied the legends and lore of all lands. She was a folklorist. And she taught the little children of Suren. I'm going to see one of them, God willing, this summer. Henriette LeBlanc. She was a young student of Noor as a child. She's in her 90s now. Lives in a little village in Switzerland. Henriette LeBlanc has told us of the classes. Children called it their catechism, their Sufi catechism. They went, and one day Noor gave a lesson on Moses. And they were given a poem by Alfred de Vigny on Moses, a French romantic poet, and studied that poem. Another day the subject was the Buddha. Another day, the subject was the teachings that Murshid's father had given to him as a child, how he had instructed him. Very rigorous. In fact, you see that rigorous, conscientious instruction that Rahman Khan gave to Hazrat Inayat Khan, then blossoming in the rules, the iron rules, copper rules, silver rules, golden rules. God willing, we'll talk about the rules tomorrow. So she held these classes for the children. And Loki apparently especially appreciated the class because at the end each child was given a bonbon. But then came the rumblings of war and news of outrages as the Nazi regime rose to power in Germany, news of outrageous persecution, brutality, and such enormities as were absolutely antithetical to the values with which Noah was raised, the value of respect toward all souls, veneration of all sacred traditions, tyranny, militant, hyper-nationalistic aggression. The shadow was growing, and Noor's stories came to answer that threat in a fascinating way. In Germany, the Brothers Grimm were romantics. They were investigators of the old lore that was becoming more and more rare in a world disenchanted and routinized and industrialized. They were looking to the hidden places, the quiet places, the unpretentious wisdom of the peasants, the old ways, the old themes, the stories of sages and heroes. They wanted to collect it. And they did. And they were interested in the lore of all peoples. And they saw that all peoples, in the tradition of Herder, the German philosopher Herder, who believed that the symphony of all of the folkloric cultures of the world is one great mosaic expressive of the divine creation of humanity. That was the vision of Herder, a universal vision to be found in the folklore of all people, that primal knowledge of story. And so the Brothers Grimm had done their part to collect the old stories of Germany while they were encouraging those of other lands to encourage the stories of their lands and studying those stories too. But the Nazis grasped on to the legacy of the Brothers Grimm and deployed it for the sake of an exclusive and supremacist racism. And they censored huge parts of German literature, but sought to press the folklore, press the old stories into the service of race consciousness. Now, what was Noor doing all the while? Something similar but completely different. She was collecting the old stories, but showing their interrelatedness, showing the unifying themes between them. The old stories of India, the old stories of Africa, the old stories of Europe. These stories have actually crossed national borders time and again. Stories migrate. Stories are no respecters of walls. So, while the Nazis were promoting Germanic folklore, Noor delved into Germanic folklore, also French folklore, also Middle Eastern folklore, also Chinese folklore, whatever story she could find. and was weaving a planetary web of story. But stories would not halt the onslaught of an army. And it was at their very doors now. And my father told me what happened next. They had been increasingly alarmed and outraged by news of the Third Reich. And now they saw, after Poland, the Nazis were heading toward France, heading toward Paris. And they conferred together in the Oriental Room. This is how my father told it to me. And their instinct was toward peace. They had no interest in harming anyone. But they remembered. Murshid had said, my father remembered, Murshid had asked them, if France is attacked, what would you do? And my father, as a child, had answered, I wouldn't want to fight and kill. But Murshid had said, and yet, if you eat the bread of a country, you must be prepared to defend that country with your life. They knew they had to take some stand. They couldn't be bystanders. So they evacuated and barely made their way to London and there volunteered to serve the Allies in the cause. And Amina Begum and Kherenissa, and at first Noor herself, they were serving as nurses. And my father eventually became a minesweeper in the channel, removing mines, and which prepared the way for the Normandy landing. And Noor entered into the Women's Auxiliary Air Force and was at last recruited for the most dangerous work of the war, which was to infiltrate enemy lines undercover and to be a link between the resistance and the Allies by wireless telegraphy. And it was so dangerous because the SOE, the command center that was sending agents, was up against the Gestapo, who were apprised of this strategy. And the Gestapo were constantly hunting down and finding and torturing and executing the agents of the SOE. So their life expectancy was only no more than a month and a half. And Noor knew this. And yet, being fluent in French and there being a dearth of available agents, she was rushed through the training and sent out to the field. And almost as soon as she arrived, the entire network was arrested, excepting herself. And so before long, she became the sole link between the French resistance and headquarters in London, and she was providing through these messages, information that was crucial to disrupting the enemy army, the Nazi army, and preparing the way for the liberation of France. It was crucial information that enabled them to sabotage supplies and supply lines and to make possible the eventual landing and liberation. So Noor, even though her position was extremely endangered, she had to send her messages out of doors. She couldn't just hide in a room. She had to go string up her wireless outside on a tree or a pole, climb up and do that in a city that was teeming with Gestapo who were hunting her personally. And she had to change her identity, had to change her appearance and go from place to place, constantly on the move, always carrying her big bulky transmitter in a suitcase through throngs of police who were out to kill her. And she succeeded for crucial weeks and rendered a crucial service during that time, exceeding all expectations. Until at last she was betrayed. Her whereabouts were sold for a price. Someone that knew her, someone connected with the resistance, betrayed her, and she was caught and taken and held captive by the Gestapo. Twice she daringly attempted escape. She was with two other prisoners. They had somehow managed to communicate and to effect an escape over the rooftop. They were on the roof. But just then, the siren sounded. There was an alert, and they were captured again. She never gave any information, whereas far more hardened agents, men, buckled under. She never did. She was taken to Forzheim and chained to a wall, wearing just a few rags, feet and hands manacled. Solitary confinement for months and months, given a bowl of potato peel soup sometimes. And she never succumbed in that aloneness, in that darkness. Yes, some other prisoners would hear her weeping at nights, but she never succumbed, she never revealed anything. And she was taken at last to Dachau, and all through the night beaten to a pulp, kicked and beaten bloody, and then made to kneel. And she said just one word, liberté, freedom. She was shot in the back of the head and thrown in the incinerator. So I told you a couple of days ago that for me it's been very hard to make myself, bring myself close to her story, though I always, since childhood, since infancy, revered her, but from a distance. But the discovery of her play has taken me into her story, has taken me into her life, and has taken actually our order to that place where we have affirmed her light in the silsila, in the shajara, the tree of lights that we hitherto had not named her. Now we name her after Hazrat Inayat Khan, Hazrat Pirzadi Shahida Noor. We say there's a lineage through her, there is a transmission through her, that her stories are a crucial unfoldment of the message that Moshe brought, and most of all, the story of her own life. So I have experienced more blessings than I can possibly name over the last several months studying her stories, one by one, living with those stories, reading them again, excavating them, what is within them, what is behind them, what do they show, what do they reveal. Like all things, her stories have levels, and also one finds in them what one brings to them. If one brings a certain readiness, more will be shown. If one reads them as some entertainment, entertainment is there. But there's more, there's more. So the Jataka tales, some of you know, many of you know the Jataka tales. Those are stories to return to again and again. So much charm, such lightness of touch. They're not overwrought. She tells them with a light touch, but so much elegance, so much charm. And in each one of them is a profound lesson for life. Profound illumination of the heart. And her own life became the fulfillment of the qualities that she described. She became the great elephant who threw down his body to feed the starving tribe that was traveling through the desert without food. She became the hare that threw itself into the fire to become meat for the hungry Saka. She became the war horse that was grievously injured in its foray into battle, but saw that one last foray was needed, even though it would not survive, and so urged the paladin to mount it once more. She was urged to return from France. She could have returned safely. She was told, it's too dangerous now. Come back. But she saw she was the last link. She's a reminder. Her life is a reminder. You know, there are teachings that teach balance. Balance of activity and repose, having good boundaries, self-care, sustainability in all things. These are all good and important and vital teachings. But there comes a time, and this is the Jatakas teach this, and Noor's life teaches this. There comes a time for sacrifice. Every moment isn't the moment for moderation. Every moment isn't the moment for self-care. There's a moment of truth. She saw that. She happened to live in one of the great momentous moments of Earth's history. There's significant momentousness in our own time, it's true. But she met that moment and delved into the dark heart of it and gave herself over to it. The Jataka tales. The play, Aid of the Ocean and Land. I never knew about it until 2 years ago. It was a terma, a hidden treasure, discovered. It retells the story of the Odyssey. But in Homer's Odyssey, at the end, Odysseus vanquishes his enemies, reclaims his home, and actually puts to death not only the rivals who had occupied his home, but even the servants that had been, he thought, disloyal. So it ends with retribution, harsh revenge. Noor's Odyssey is very different, because in Noor's Odyssey, Odysseus is Murshid. It's Homer's story, but it's also the story of her family. Murshid is Odysseus. She is Telemachus. And she retells the adventures of Odysseus in his travels from Troy to Ithaca, through the seven valleys of Manticotere, the seven valleys of Attar, seven acts in the play. Following love into the realm of renunciation. But then even beyond renunciation, that's the inner arc of the story. Odysseus renounces at last. He renounces home. He had fought so hard to get back home, to reclaim what was his. But when he finally reaches it, he gives it up. He becomes a sannyasin. But at the same moment, Penelope and Telemachus undergo their own renunciation, but they bring Odysseus to a higher renunciation, which is not the renunciation of seclusion and remoteness, but the renunciation of togetherness in non-attachment, togetherness in an openness of spirit, not going back to the old attachments, the old binds, going forward to freedom, but going forward together, not alone. Freedom together. That's the conclusion of Aid of the Ocean and Land. You'll find many gems of insights in that work, and I do recommend it to you. It's now been published. by Siluk Press, and it's been enacted at the Zenith Camp last year. And in fact, we have among us Ulis. Ulis. So in just a moment, I'm going, not quite yet, but very soon, Ulis, Julia, I'm going to turn to you because you find in the play the song of the Majzub. The whole story is about Noor's relationship with her father. And very soon after he left this world, she composed a song, which is called The Song to the Majzub. And it communicates her heart in the words, in the melody. So we have the great good fortune to hear it from you in just a moment. Tarana, who's been singing each morning, she was musically directing the performance, and it was something never to forget in the mountains there. The music, the lines, the evocation of the seven valleys. God willing, we can do it again. Do it in America also. And in fact, there's some real chance it may be done in Greece, God willing. So aid of the ocean and land. And then also I want to call to your attention the stories in King Akbar's Daughter. King Akbar's Daughter. These are posthumously published stories of Noor from all different sources. Indian, Chinese, European. There's a story from the Masnavi retold there, and also stories that Noor herself had invented. And even if you've read them before, read them again with new eyes, you know? You'll find something more. I've been digging deeply into them and finding layer after layer. In fact, they're ancient archetypes in these stories. If you read the story of Snowdrop. Do you know Snowdrop? Does that ring a bell? Personnage, the story. The last, I think it's the last in the collection, Snowdrop. It's a short story. Noor wrote it herself. It's inspired by Snow White, but it has deeper roots that go back all the way to Eleusis, the Eleusinian mysteries, the mystery of Persephone and Demeter is encoded in Snowdrop. And it's also a premonition of Noor's own fate. When she became a victim of Nacht und Nebel, Hitler's program of disappearing his most dangerous adversaries. And Noor was one. Nacht und Nebel was the program to torture and isolate and murder those who opposed most powerfully the Nazi program. And it's personified in anticipation in Snowdrop through the henchmen of Queen Winter, who are Frostbite, and Fog Gloom. Who bury great son's daughter under the ground and all of nature withers, and a great sadness is on the land. Until the two robins look for snowdrop and they tap on the ground. Tap, 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 tap. Snowdrop, snowdrop, are you there? Yes, I am here. You must return. No, for Queen Winter will kill me. Great Sun's daughter, the trees have abandoned their leaves and the birds no longer sing in the trees, and all is barren. All are sad and miss you. Hush! I will come, but I will come as a snowdrop, and Queen Winter will not see me. And out of the snow arises this humble, gentle little flower. But the robins know. Great Sun's daughter is back, and the hares, the fluffy ones, the big brown ones, they know. Great Sun's daughter has returned, and the flowers open again, and green spreads across the land, and the season of the rose comes again. Noor was buried underground, but the snow drop is rising, and those who see it, who witness it, know that summer is here. May we hear the song of the Mudzoop.
Lotus.
want soup. I come to see.